If I attack myself or I attack you, there must be something I'm afraid of in this conversation. I just started owning these things and exploring them, and I committed to suffer.
Our greatest challenges are often caused from a victim mentality and toxic self-loathing. But when we take responsibility for our commitments, healing begins. Therefore, tune into this powerful episode with the impactful Dan Tocchini and discover how to bring order from chaos and release the beauty within. Welcome to the Forged by Trust podcast. I'm your host, Robin Drake, professional speaker, executive coach, former U.S. Marine, spy recruiter, best-selling author, and your trust and communication expert. Coming up next on the Forged by Trust podcast.
If you want to feel better, if you want to know what it takes to lead, then you better learn and feel good about leading. You better learn to have hard conversations. So if I keep working with who I am, the possibilities are going to emerge. And usually they emerge as threats first, and then they open up as possibilities. I got to face into them.
The Forged by Trust podcast is a show where we explore the essential skill of forging trust for building an innovative culture and exceptional leadership. Join us as we delve into the behavior skills and communication techniques required for success and learn from the best in the industry. Our guests include spies, spy recruiters, master interrogators, best-selling authors, thought leaders, and innovators who will share their insights on building teams, partnerships, and exceptional leadership by forging trust. Today's episode, How to Thrive in Conflict, is with the deeply impactful Dan Tocchini. Dan is a seasoned transformationalist with decades of experience in developing high-performing work cultures. Dan has had the privilege of working with industry giants like ESPN, Microsoft, and Interstate Batteries, as well as founders and teams from Virgin Hyperloop, One Hope Winery, and Smarty Pants Vitamins, and nonprofits like Homeboy Industries, World Vision, and Straight Ahead Ministries. As a founder or executive leader or high-performing team looking to take your organization to the next level, Dan's expertise lies in strategic executive leadership development, conflict resolution, organizational change management, turnaround consulting, and restructuring. Through personalized coaching, hands-on training, and proven methodologies, Dan works with founders and their teams to take their organizations to unprecedented levels of meaning and productivity engineer the transformation needed to exceed your business objectives while deepening your sense of meaning and purpose. During today's episode, we talk about the revelations of a near-death experience, the toxin of self-loathing, making a commitment to heal, learning to love a hard conversation, never giving up on those we love, creating possibilities from obstacles and ordering chaos and releasing beauty. All right, Dan, thank you so much for taking time out of your incredibly busy day and journey to spend it with me, my audience, and the Forged by Trust podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Robin. It's a real pleasure to be here. I always enjoy talking with you, and I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
And oh my gosh, if people could see the few seconds ago before we started the recording, just as soon as your face hit my screen, I just lit up. You have this amazing energy that just emanates from you. And I know it comes from this really profound background and journey you're on. And we're going to go through that in a second. But I'm just so thankful for having you part of my life. And I'm so glad that you've decided to grace all of us with yours. And so with that, Dan, the title of our episode today is How to Thrive in Chaos, which life is full of. And that's a pretty profound statement right there and a pretty tall order. So where did that journey begin that we needed to come out of chaos?
Well, I mean, there's the personal aspect, and then there's just the fact that life is chaotic. You know, there's if you get out in the world, there's so much diversity, it's chaos. It's people living and doing, and there are different concerns, and some of them aren't so, let's say, life-giving. Some concerns are dark. And so you've got all these competing forces going on. But particularly for me, as a young boy, I grew up in a home with my mother was a schizophrenic, and it didn't hit till I was about 12 years old. So,
okay. Yeah. All right. I got to stop, slow down. Where do we grow up?
I grew up in Northern California.
Okay.
And in the wine country that's now known as the wine country. When I was a kid, it was Napa only, but I grew up in a little town called Petaluma. And my mother and father, my dad, my grandfather actually settled in Sebastopol, which is about 16 miles northwest. of Petaluma, and then my dad settled in Petaluma.
Oh, wow. And where'd your grandfather come from?
He came from a little town called Porcari in Italy, just outside of Lucca, Italy.
Wow. Close family?
Very close. Catholic family. Grew up very close. You know, would go to my grandfather's every weekend or every week. And then at about 12, my parents, you know, my mother had my younger brother, he's 9 years younger than me. And just after that, the episodes with the manic depression and then the schizophrenia came on.
Yeah. So what did that look like back then, if you don't mind me asking? It's a challenging thing, obviously, to go through. So what did that manifest like in the house, and what did that do?
Well, it's kind of, well, did you see A Beautiful Mind?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So
the only clips of it, not the entire thing.
I saw it once, was enough for me. And it was a fairly clean kind of idea of what it looks like, what it's like. But you don't know you don't know what's going on for the person. Mm. And they're doing things that make no sense at all, but make sense to them.
Right.
And they're not predictable. All of a sudden, you know, one day it's really, things are very clean and in order. And the next day, depressed in bed. And then she started hearing sounds. And so there was and mood swings. And my dad was gone a lot. I think that was part of it. You know, there was a lot, of course, very complex situation. But in talking with my mother.
And what did your dad do?
My dad he's in the movie business. He has movie theaters. Oh. And then, you know, exhibition of motion picture theaters. My grandfather opened the first talking motion picture theater north of San Francisco and was involved in, you know, the establishment of United Artists Theater Circuit. He built a number of their first theaters, their first four theaters.
Wow. So he immigrates from Italy and starts movie theaters. Where'd that come from?
He and his brother started a produce market, were part of the founders of the produce market in San Francisco. And they opened up grocery stores, and he lived north of the bay, and they had set up grocery stores and got into real estate over a period of time and built a movie theater for some guys who were supposed to come out, I think from the East Coast somewhere and open it. They were going to be his tenants, and they didn't show up. So he ended up opening the theater and learning the business and liked it so much that he sold his grocery stores and went into the theater business.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then he had your dad.
And my dad kind of followed in his footsteps and took the business to a whole nother level. And, you know, my dad was big into gambling. You know, at that time, he'd go play low ball. And so he'd play cards as a hobby and was gone a lot. And I think the pressure of raising three boys and a girl with my mother and then other things within their relationship were so dynamic. In talking with her in later years, we talked about that. She felt like she didn't have any way out, and she felt like what she had made up about the situation altered her body chemistry. That's what, and she said she just noticed that, you know, she would go off into these different realities, and it was a way for to escape the pressure of what she was feeling. At least that was part of it. That's what she described it as.
Oh, so you had chaos enter your life pretty early.
Early, yeah.
And it sounds, as you described it, it doesn't sound like it made you feel very safe or those people around you safe or predictable either, correct?
No, I know. I just love my mother. You know, I love my mother and father, love my brothers and sisters. And I just didn't want to lose her. So I pursued her while she was in the hospital. And I became kind of the go-between between her and the psychiatrist. At one point, I had talked my father into letting me give it a shot because the psychiatrist he'd flown in and hired.
And give what a shot? Her,
yeah, to connect with her. She was catatonic at the time. She'd go in and out of catatonia and hurt herself. She'd kind of pull her hair out or do things to hurt herself. Never hurt any of us. Never was violent toward us. In fact, you know, and looking back, she's like a hero to me. I could tell what it took for her to take care of us. And she did was really tough because she was, you know, struggling with this.
Oh my God.
And anyway, I was able to reach her by visiting her in the hospital. And And I had read, I started reading books on how to, how could I connect with her? And I read these neuro-linguistic programming books, which it wasn't very popular then. And I read some work by a guy named Charles Schraz, which he wrote a book called The Myth of Mental Illness. And his frame was, these people aren't mentally ill, schizophrenics, or they're using a language that they kind of made up to deal with reality. And that if we need to learn to speak the language with them or find out what they're doing. She would symbolize, she would do all kinds of really weird stuff, but I could tell it meant something to her because there was a consistency in what she would do. Like she'd move a salt shaker or, reorganize the plates and then sit back like, you see, like she was saying something to us, and it would freak out my dad and my brothers and sisters, and they would leave the table, and I would move things around trying to figure out what she was saying. Right.
Did you ever figure it out?
Well, I learned to communicate with her. Yeah, I did. In fact, as I got older, there was a cycle that would happen. She would go, if she went into a cycle, she took lithium, which helped her. She actually lived a life of her own on her own till she was 82 when she died.
Wow.
And in the later 30 or 40 years of her life, she only had a couple of episodes. Right. She wouldn't take her medicine. She wouldn't take the lithium.
Right.
And she told me one time, I asked her like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? She goes, well, it's just so nice. I feel so good when I'm there, And so it was a process of really negotiating with her to take to do her meds, and we as a family would work on that. And there was a cycle. She would go off on one of her trips, and she would disturb her neighbors. And pretty soon, some of the kids would go over and try to work with her. And then I'd get a call from a family friend, and he would say, "You need to go talk to your mother." And then I'd go over and sit with her, and then I'd get her to admit herself on a 5150. In the hospital on her own volition. And then that would be the start. And then I would go in, and later on, I became the one that basically, unless I signed off, she wouldn't get out. Right. So I could talk to her about staying on the meds. Right. And that worked out well. I mean, like I said, she died at 82 and she did well. She had a great sense of humor. She's very bright. And I asked her, why didn't you ever get married again? She goes, "Oh, nobody wants to marry us." She had a great sense of humor.
What a soul.
Very brilliant, very bright, very intuitive. Had no, it seemed like she had no approval needs. She'd say whatever she thought. And of course, that could be problematic.
Right. So your parents separated then?
Yeah, they were divorced. They divorced when I was 18. And then my dad remarried some 10 years later and been married ever since. And my mom and my dad and his wife Amy, all the family just reconciled well over the years. We had holidays together. My dad bought her a home, took care of her, oversaw, they were good friends.
So we're going through some interesting times in high school, learning to communicate with your mom.
Yeah.
And at this point in life, what were you thinking you're going to do with it?
Nothing. I wanted to get away from it. Pretty angry, rebellious, didn't want to deal.
What was making you angry and rebellious?
Oh, the situation between she and my father and judgments I had of my dad and of just different circumstances. And I found myself lying and cheating, and I got into drugs and, doing illegal things like gang life type of stuff. And really, I figured I was going to be dead by the time I was 30 at some point.
Why was that?
I was so angry. I could tell that where I was headed. I don't know. And most people can when they're in a situation that has a short-term gain, but a long-term pain. You're settling for short-term relief, but you're creating long-term grief because I'm breaking relationships. I'm lying. I'm cheating. I'm leading a double life. I marry my wife. And I have a movie theater, a couple of theaters, and I'm laundering money through there, and people aren't coming to the theaters. I'm dealing drugs and doing really illegal things. And she eventually finds that out after my son was born, about a year into it, and basically drew the line and said, look, we can't do, we have a life we have to take care of, and I can't do this anymore. It's not going to work for me. So you got to make a choice. And that's when things started to, I decided to turn. Although I felt quite hopeless, things were as chaotic as they could be. My wife wants to leave. My dad doesn't want to talk to me because I'm lying. He knows I'm a drug addict and a dealer, and he doesn't want to get involved.
How old were you when all this was happening?
26, 25.
Right. That's in there. A lot.
Yeah. And it was just really, I'll never forget the feeling. Like, I didn't think I could do anything legitimate. And I was always an avid reader, and I was articulate and I could sell, but I didn't, you know, I had no idea that I could make a living. So that was a big deal. That was a lot of the fear. That was the chaos, was a way for me to cover up what I was doing from people to a certain degree, but eventually they would find out. So I had this kind of self-loathing. When are they going to find out who I really am and then not want to be with me? That kind of thing. That dark side.
So what was it then that really turned that moment, made that moment happen for you?
I had a big faith experience. I got in a head-on car accident. My son was, I was not yet born yet. So it happened just before I stopped all the drugs, and I got in a car wreck and had a...
And if I could pause there a second too, you're pretty remarkable, Dan, because you're brushing through things that are really difficult and challenging to stop doing. And first to realize, if you don't mind, just sure. A second, the drug addiction. That is a rough thing for people to break.
Yeah. Well, it's rough because I was investing in something that brought no meaning, except right. that it would temporarily relieve my suffering. In a sense, it would numb me.
Right.
But investing like that, there was no meaning. I felt despair. There was no meaning. There was no reason to stand up. I loved my wife, but I didn't feel like I was, like, she didn't know me. And so how could she love me? So she probably wouldn't want to have me, right? If she found out who I really was in my, you know, my own mind.
Right.
And so the thought of losing her in this, so I had this debt, I died and came back. I died, they actually, you know, tied the little tag on and I.
All right, so let's go through that event then. So we're in a little self-loathing going on. You know,
yeah, just a little.
We're medicating through drugs.
Yeah.
We're married, we're afraid our wife is going to see us for who we really are, and we're afraid of losing her. And
I have a little boy I love to just like, you know, but I don't think I can get up to being his father. I'm terrified. Inside, I'm very scared. Right. Outside, I'm projecting arrogance and confidence. Like, I think it's confidence, but it's coming across as arrogance because it's really a cover for the fear that's going on in me. And my wife is the one who brings that to my attention multiple times.
Right.
And she has me, I end up doing a training called, it was a LifeSpring, it was a company called LifeSpring. And that was extremely powerful for me. It started me looking at what it would take to take responsibility for the future I'm committed to.
And so, and when did we take this training? Was this before the accident?
I had taken it before the accident, but it really didn't, it affected me, but not like I'm a little stiff-necked. So nice. Before the accident, 2 years before the accident, I get in the accident. I have this faith experience. Now I come back and I actually experience what I, you know, I'm a very kinesthetic guy, so it wasn't visual.
And we're going to get into that in a second. I'm just trying to paint the picture of where, yeah. what the sequence of events are happening.
So I had done this training. 2 years late, 2 years later, I get in the car wreck.
Tell me about the car wreck. How did this car wreck happen?
Head on the freeway going home from a new Academy Award party at my dad's house. I'm driving home. I've got some cocaine in the car. I'm high. And I get hit head on the freeway, two guys drunk going the wrong way. Cars are 20 feet apart, engine 20 feet under the car.
Wow.
So they take me to the hospital. I've femur compound fracture, but broke my jaw in 5 different places, teeth knocked out, both lungs collapsed. I can barely breathe. There's a big 5-inch rip in my diaphragm, and the lungs are between down there. I'm bleeding internally. I lost 4-5 pints of blood in the whole process.
How did they find you? I mean, how were they able to get to you so fast and you didn't die?
It's pretty remarkable. There was a highway patrolman pretty close to me, and I had woke up in the car and was pawing my way, trying to find out. He opened the car door and said, "Stop. Don't do anything. You know, just wait till the ambulance gets here." Ambulance comes, they take me out, and then they get me to the hospital. They phone I give them my wife's number, and she comes to the hospital. So, and this is in 81. So this is 2 years before my son's born. And then my son's born. And at the time I'm still doing some work with LifeSpring, but I'm still dabbling in the drugs, I have a theater that I still work with and doing the stuff I was talking about. I'm still doing that. And that's when my wife really gets what's going on and says, "Look, you got to stop this."
So where was the near-death experience? Was it that accident right there, or was it another one?
That was the accident. That was it.
Would you share it, please?
Well, so I died on the table. They brought me back, and then I died again after the operation, and I died, and they took the tubes out and wheeled me out and started. I remember pulling the cover over my head. But before I did that, I had this experience. Like, you ever go to sleep, and just before you sleep, you're in that state where it's like really comfortable. You don't even feel your body. You're just really comfortable. It was like that, but on steroids, like times 10. And I felt this hand going through my head, speaking to me. I heard a voice. I didn't have any sight. I just felt it and heard this voice saying, "Do you want to stay with me, or do you want to go back to work? You have a lot of work to do if you go back, but you can stay with me." And I said, I thought about it, and I had kind of a view of, I wanted to have kids, and I saw family, and I saw all these different things. And I said, "Well, I want to go back." And I was back in my body and pulling the cover over. And look, in this, I hear this nurse saying, "He's alive." And then she's wheeling me quickly back in the room, and they start putting tubes back in me, there's a breather, and then I go back out. And when I wake up, in the intensive care room, I can't remember who I am. And I don't remember who this woman is or people there, but I'm on a breather because I can't talk, because it's breathing for me. And I'm trying to figure out, and that goes on for like 3 hours before my memories start to return.
3 hours. Yeah. Wow.
Because I'm watching the clock, and I don't know why I'm saying this. Palms together, palms apart. Palms together, palms apart. Just surrender. And when I start to get my memories back, I remember who my wife is. My dad's there. Things come into focus. I remember what happened. I got in a wreck. I remember, them wheeling me back, and all that starts to come into focus. And the words "palms together, palms apart" was a surrender exercise we did at LifeSpring years before. Huh. And it was about surrendering. Like, if you want to order chaos, if you want to bring order, you want to bring something into being, you have to be with what is first. And so I started to realize at that point, that's what I needed to do to recover, is just be where I'm at and really engage that, right? And so I did, and they thought I'd be in the hospital for 4 or 5 months. I was out in 3 weeks, and then I spent a week at home, which was probably the worst week of the whole time because the body's waking up.
Right.
But the whole time, that theme of surrender was with me. And
the body's waking up. That's an interesting statement. What do you mean the body is waking up?
I got hit on a head-on, right? So that I got hit in the chest, and my sternum touched my spine, collapsed my lungs, broke my jaw. So it's a trauma, And right. So the nerves are coming back alive. And my leg was like this huge because it was, they had to drive a pin through the hip down to the knee and put the bone back together on it. Okay. So they kind of, they pulverized my thigh muscle. And so when the body's, after a few weeks, it starts to wake up. It starts to come out with a numbness. Right. So I'm hurting all over and the legs throbbing. I can barely sleep. And that was that's where the surrender really came in, where I could.
Plus, you're probably going through withdrawal too at this point, yes?
Well, yeah. Kind of funny you don't feel that because with all that pain. But
right.
On cocaine, there's not really a withdrawal. It's more of a side. There is in a sense that you're going to be edgy and that kind of thing, but it's not like heroin where you have a physical withdrawal, but you feel it. And so for a long time, now over a year, I'm not doing drugs.
Right.
Because I'm recovering. But at the end of that year, now we're in 82, Danny's born in 83, it starts up again. I start doing drugs again. I start doing cocaine again.
Why do you think that happened?
Despair. Still wrestling with my own loathing, feeling like, now I've trashed my body. It was a really, and I've hurt myself. So, I'm not going to be playing as many sports as I used to. I can't, because I do like, I was athletic as well.
Right.
Ironically. And I'm just, it's like a pause. I still didn't believe that I could get something done that I there were so many lies that had to get cleared up still.
Right.
And I held them against me rather than get them clear. Look, to play the victim is so much easier than getting responsible. And at least in the short term.
Right.
And being a criminal is a negotiation, like life's a negotiation. So if I'm a victim, I have a different stance in how I negotiate my life than if I'm responsible, if I'm relating to it responsibly. So if I'm relating to it as a victim, I'm always using my past to determine and to justify what I'm taking from others now. And so I can perpetrate against them because after all, I've been done wrong to, I'm entitled to right. do what I feel like others have done to me.
Right.
Right. And so, I was born with this situation with my mother. I was misunderstood. I mean, I had a whole story. And the chaos of that was a cover. Like I could get dramatic and would take people's attention off of me, or I could produce a dramatic situation and it would be about that, not me. Right. There was a lot of different pathologies that I was exercising and quite unconsciously at times. And as I started getting responsible for having something new happen, like a family that worked and a business that was legitimate and that it would express my deepest desires, that produces a different world and a different sense of meaning. So that there's a struggle there. It's so tempting for the short, it's like a drug addict. I could have the short numbness and feel good for the moment. Right. But then when I come down, I'm despairing. And so
what flipped that switch from being a victim and wound collector to a problem solver?
When my wife said to me, we've got a son and I can't play this game with you anymore. I'm going to be responsible for him. If you aren't willing to do what it takes to do that, I got to live without you. I don't want to. And I want you to be his father, but I can't make you do it. I'll take him and I'll divorce you. And that's when I really started. And ironically, one night I'm sitting I'm chopping up some cocaine. It's raining outside and my wife's in bed and Danny's asleep and it's late at night. And I'm lamenting this while I'm doing this cocaine. This is how screwy we can get, right? Mm. And I sit back and I read John 3:16. I just happened to look down. She had the Bible open. And God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. And so I just thought to myself, I wonder what that means. Just kind of in a cocaine days. Uh-huh. I wonder what that means. Like, what would it be like to have to give my son up? I'm not visual, as I said. And all of a sudden I get this vision of her walking away, holding my son's hand when he's about four. In this case, he's only a year at this point, but I see him about four and they both turn around, look at me. And he says, you could have been my daddy crying. I want you to be my daddy. And she said, but, you know, like no. And they turned around and walked off. And it was so real that it convicted me. That's all I can say. It punctured me. I walked out and I dumped about 2 ounces of cocaine on the lawn in the rain. And I looked up and promised God, I said, I will stand. And I remember seeing in the raindrops faces of people falling on me. I'll never forget it. And wow. I didn't know what it meant, but I just knew that this was what I needed to do. And I didn't say anything to Eileen. I just told her I need to go to this place called Coke Enders and do this for a week, and I'll be back. I'm not going to say anything, because so many times in the past you say you're going to quit and you don't.
Right.
So I go to Coke Enders and I come back and I start putting to work what I learned at the trainings I had done, what I'd read in the scripture about being responsible and things I worked through. And, you know, I just started owning these things and exploring them. And I committed to suffer. If it meant suffering, then that's what I would do. That what was more important to me was to have a meaningful relationship with my wife and my son than to appease my momentary suffering, my pain. And I remember I decided that whenever I felt like I was going to do the drug, I would pray. And that worked for me. And I would, you know, I went to AA or CA meetings for a while, but then, you know, I started doing my own business. I started getting involved with, the training company I had done. I went back and started working for them. And I wanted to learn that because I really enjoyed that. And then I started studying very deeply all the things I was interested in for the sake of benefiting my family. And that the goal was to have a family, that I decided that success for me would be that we would have children and that those children would want to live. They would want to be with me throughout their life. And if they wanted to be with me throughout my life, if they wanted to share life with me, I had succeeded. Even like, so if we were poor, we would right. joyously be together. We would be together in a way that would generate possibility. We'd learn how to work. When they got married, they'd want their kids to be, you know, they'd want me to be their grandfather, et cetera. And Eileen and I talked about these things as a vision.
It's a great, perfect, simple vision in life, isn't it? When you decomplicate life and just make it about the only thing that matters, and that's good, healthy, strong relationships to those people we care about, life is poetic journey. So we have a beautiful transformation, hard one that's happening. What was next?
Well, I fell in love with being with people and making a difference with them. Because
I fell in love with being with people. What made you fall in love with being with people?
I could see similar struggles that people were having that I struggled with. Mm. And I felt like I could stand with them in a way that they would see a possibility that they maybe didn't see in that moment.
Right.
And that, not that I could do it for them, but that I could be a catalyst to support them if that's what they really wanted, that I could make a difference.
Right.
And that every time I successfully did that and saw somebody do something they didn't think they could do, but they longed to do, I was happy for them. It was the joy for them was a payoff, was worth doing. And even if they didn't acknowledge me, it didn't matter. It was like they were doing it. And I got to be part of that.
What did your wife start seeing in you that was different, do you think, at this time?
She told me she always saw this in me. She told me she was sad because I didn't see it in me. She used to sit and look at me when I was in that state. And she'd say, what are you thinking? You look so sad. And I'd get so mad at her. I'd get contemptuous because she'd be exposing me to me. Mm. And I'd stomp out and throw a little tantrum, go leave, get in the car, drive off. And she'd cry and she'd say, I don't know why you do that to yourself. Why? Tell me what's going on. And I knew if I told her, if she knew, she'd never want to be. I'm not who she thinks I am. But I wasn't who I thought I was. There was this dark side. It didn't have to be the bigger side. And I began to connect with how the dark side could be an ally instead of an enemy.
When was the first time you had the courage to let go of the shame of sharing?
Well, when my wife asked me, I came to her and committed, I confessed I had committed adultery a few times, with 9 times through the first 10 years of our history. Every year I'd go have a fling. I never knew why. I didn't understand it at the time. But when I confessed it to her, she started naturally asking, well, who is it? Who are the people? Like, and then she starts asking very detailed questions. About the third question, I got really angry and got up to storm out. And she said, oh, so you were just using me one more time? Like, who are you confessing for?
That's a good question.
And stopped me dead in my tracks, because when she said it, I realized, wow, she's right. Here I am again.
Using her.
Doing it. It's really for me. I'm trying to relieve my guilt instead of reconnect with her.
Right.
Because you just don't want to see who you've been up until now. And that's who you need to see. So I turned around and I sat down and we went through the whole process. And by the end of an hour and a half, 2 hours of confessing, I'm sweating. And we decided that I asked her to forgive me. She said she would, but she didn't know if she wanted to stay with me, which I understood. I had to face that. And then we agreed that since we had Danny, we needed to develop a respectful and honorable relationship, because he's going to be affected by it, because we both have been affected by broken families, you know, divorce and so on at the time. And so I slept in a separate bedroom, and the agreement was I would sleep there, and that at some point, if she felt like it wasn't going to work out, I would leave and we'd work something out. Or if she felt like she was ready to go and she wanted to stand with me and again and recommit, she'd let me know to come back to the bedroom. So we'd meet in the morning and talk over coffee and breakfast. And then I'd go off to work at LifeSpring, and then I would come home. And then at night we play with Danny and like that. So at one point I asked her, well, you know, we're eating away at our savings. We've got about, because we bought this home and we're paying the rent, and what I'm making isn't enough. And I'm working 70 hours a week. So I asked her, you know, is there some way you can help? And then we get in an argument, and it would sound something like, well, yes, I want to help. I said, no, you don't. You just said you didn't want to help. She goes, I didn't say that. And we'd argue. And then my dark side, I'd throw a tantrum and leave.
Right.
And then I go down to work with people on how to communicate. Then I come back home that night and we'd talk to Danny, because we would play with Danny. So we wouldn't talk, and then go to bed the next morning. This happens again. And I leave even quicker the second morning. Again, same argument. You don't want to help. Yes, I do. No, you don't. I came home that night. Again, the second night, we'd play with Danny, went to bed. The third morning I come in, she's got a tape recorder on the counter. And I go, what's that for? She goes, well, Mr. Trainer, it seems that we're not communicating well, and you say one thing and I say another. We're missing something, so I thought I'd use the tape recorder and we could see what we're missing, instead of you storming off and me staying at home and wondering what's going on. And, you know, I said, okay, well, good, let's do it. So she puts it on, and sure enough, we start talking about 20 minutes in, and we're arguing. We forget it's on. I'm getting ready to blow out. She goes, don't run away. Let's just hear what the recorder says. So I said, okay. I said, well, you didn't say that. You're not willing to help. You said you are, but you're not. And so you play the recorder, and it says this. Well, Eileen, look, I don't know how long we can go like this. We got to figure something out. She goes, I'm willing to help, Dan. I'm just not willing to leave Danny at a babysitter's. I said, so you don't want to help? She goes, I didn't say that. She goes, well, that's what you meant. So I turn off the tape recorder, and I say to her, yes, okay, you're right. You didn't say you didn't want to help. But like I said there, that's what you meant. And she starts to cry. And I think in my mind, I'm angry that she's crying because she's trying to manipulate me. So the street in me, the street sense goes, okay, if you're willing to help, what are you willing to do? Let's think. And so she goes to her purse and pulls out a business plan for a daycare that she wants to build in our house. And she shows me the numbers, and it would not only make enough to make a rent, but we could save money. I'm shocked. I'm dumbfounded. I'm astounded at the prejudice in me. And this opens up a number of conversations that deepens our relationship. Now, mind you, we're sleeping in separate rooms. Now we're talking at night and in the morning. And I'm listening. I'm doing a lot of listening. I'm realizing I don't know this beautiful woman I've lived with. I only know her in relationship to what she does for me. That's how narcissistic I see I am.
Yeah.
And she says to me, don't hate yourself or you won't hear me. Right? And I realize that my self-loathing is a racket that I use to stay away from what I think I can't get up to. So I engage in these conversations and I realize, she asked me one time, what was the adultery about? Like, let's talk about that. And so we started looking at patterns, and I would do it every September for like 8 years, 9 years in a row. And it would be with a woman, it wasn't an ongoing thing, but it would be with a woman. And she goes, have you ever thought about what that's about? And I go, no, I haven't. So it was really troubling. There was a pattern there. So there's something connected to it, right?
Right.
So I just started thinking about it. And I realized at one night I sat up in bed and it was my mother. I remember the first time I remember finding out that my mother was crazy or schizophrenic. Right.
Schizophrenic.
Was in September.
Huh.
And I remember saying to myself, I can't trust her. I can't trust women. And I started feeling in me that, what did I feel when I did these things? I felt like I could still go out and be relevant to other women. So when Eileen left me, or if she left me, I could always take care of myself. She couldn't devastate me. That kind of thinking. Wow. Criminal thinking. And from that time on, I never, ever again did I even, I think women are beautiful, but I just don't entertain those thoughts. It's not even, it's like all of a sudden I got really clear and I got really devoted to her, and her trust in me is went right up. And it's interesting to note that just a week or so after those conversations, I come home one night and there's a note on my bed, come back to bed. I'm committed to this relationship. Right. And it came out of that series of conversations.
I'm completely dumbfounded by the gift of your wife to you.
Oh, you have no idea. You have no idea. She's a remarkable woman. She is the most tenacious person I've ever met. You know, she grew up in a home where her father beat her brothers and never touched her. So she wrestles with survivor's guilt. And, but she will not give up. I mean, that's her strength and her weakness. Yeah. And that was part of our codependency, because she wouldn't
walk out on you.
Yeah. And she needed to. And when she did, it's what opened up the whole conversation.
Universe has a phenomenal way of doing the right things at the right time with the right people, doesn't it?
Oh, man, I'm telling you.
So, Dan, bring us up to what you're doing now, bring an order out of chaos, because, boy, you lived in chaos. As a matter of fact, I don't think I should be talking to you. I should be talking to your wife.
She's, you know, in fact, Eileen heads up I have a company called Take New Ground, and it's it's a consulting firm, and we do turnarounds and conflict resolution, and we do all kinds of different things to start and help companies turn around. Companies, establish boards and leadership teams, and the kinds of conversations that work, how to negotiate, basically create agreement, because leadership is all about causing results through people. Right. So if you want to feel better, if you want to know what it takes to lead, then you better learn and feel good about leading. You better learn to have hard conversations. And we have found that the greater possibilities live in the conflict that most people want to try to work around instead of get into and understand and then utilize to open up the next possibility. And my life has been, those conversations are what led me into this work. And I studied all kinds of modalities, et cetera, that I could exercise and work with in my own life and in my own businesses, and then go out and support other founders to do the same thing. And I met up with Adrian in a very similar way. So, yeah. And you've had Adrian on your call. So,
yeah, and his episode is already aired. And so, what a duo, and what a group you have brought together. So, for those that are listening, what are like a few things people could do right now to help themselves so they can help others to bring some order to chaos?
Well, the baseline principles is take responsibility for what it is you're committed to having. Most people hear that, though, like to take the blame. It has nothing to do. It's the exact opposite of blaming yourself. Right. So blame, shame, and credit are all part of a system that looks to the past to justify, rationalize, etc. Responsibility has to do with the future. Like, what future am I committed to? And how can I stand now, wherever I'm at, and have this bring forth that future now, in this moment? And so that's a very different set of questions than blame, shame, and credit. Responsibility is a stand for what I'm committed to, and that what I have right now is perfect. It's the resource for that future. And if I was standing in that future looking back now, how would I engage these circumstances from there versus engaging them from some past victim story or justification or whatever for why I'm here now? Like, and when I listen to people, you can listen to yourself. When you sit down to give an account to your spouse or to your manager or your employees, you're working together, how much of the conversation is about justifying how you got there? And how much of the conversation is about understanding what's wanted and needed to bring, like, what worked, what didn't work, and now what's wanted and needed to have this turn out now, to have this future that I say matters to me turn out now?
And you're doing the gold standard right there. You're asking the what questions, not the why questions.
We're asking the who questions.
Right.
Who is it? Because it's a who.
Right.
Then what comes out of who, right? Right. Like, right. When I started being willing to consider what I was doing to myself and hating myself, like, I wonder what the benefit of that was. Who do I become when that happens? Right. And right. What I started to realize is when I start to, there are certain things that come up for me. Like, if I want to, my first thing is to attack. Whereas right. Many people, or if I attack myself or I attack you, there must be something I'm afraid of in this conversation. I wonder what it is. So that mechanism, when it comes up, is an ally. It informs me that now I rather than attack, I should, this the opportunity is here to get into an inquiry to see if what I'm afraid of is really going on or not, to see what's possible with what's going on right now. And rather than try to defend myself what I'm afraid it is, then that takes some real practice. And of course, surround yourself with people who think like that, then great. What people tend to do is surround themselves with people who buy into their stories about why they can't and justify why it's okay to settle for what little they have.
Absolutely. Poetic.
And I'm not talking about quantitatively, like family wise, like,
right.
You know, my daughter, I had a situation with her when we were younger and she was going goth and everything. And, you know, we're having a party at my house and we're celebrating it. And my son's best friend's there and they're all friends, my daughter, his friend, and my son. And we were celebrating this guy's father's 50th birthday. And after we have dinner, my son goes off with his girlfriend to do homework, and Eileen sits with her, his friend, it's her friend. They're going to hang out together, and we're eating dessert. And my wife gets this premonition, this kid's forcing himself on my daughter. She goes upstairs and catches him doing it. So you can imagine the drama that ensues and how uncomfortable it is. So we, as best we can, get them out the door. I go up to talk to my daughter, and she just basically, fuck you, I'm not talking to you. Sorry about that.
Yeah. I want to know where your wife hangs her superhero cape.
I'm she's pretty amazing. But in the long run, I just told my daughter, I'm going to get, you know, I need to talk about this. She goes, I'm not talking to you about it. And I said, well, then I'm going to pick you up every day after school and, you know, and work with it. And the first day I come home with her, I go, okay, so let's talk. What do you got for homework? And she looks at me and she goes, oh, is this your way of being a good dad? Is this what you think you're going to do now? You're just going to come in here and do this? And I was like, oh, she got me. She nailed me. And I said, probably, yeah, that I don't want to be here. And I am, you're right. And 3 months it takes. And one day I'm completely desperate. I'm run out all the techniques. Nothing's working. This is the who. I've done everything I know what to do.
Right.
And I've even called friends. And so I just keep declaring to her my commitment. And on the way to dance class in the snow, I pull over. I'm desperate. I look at her and I just break. I say, I get it. I'm a horrible father. I don't know how to love you. I don't know what it's going to take. I see you getting colder and colder. It's been 3 months. You're angry because I've not, all you get to do is go to school and go to dance. And I'm always taking you and we're doing this. And I get it's not working. And I break and I just tell her, but I want you to know one thing. I'm never giving up. I'm never giving up. I was put on this planet for this. You're my daughter. I love you. I see that there's a possibility and I can't get to it, but I want you to know I love you. Even if you turn me down, I love you. And she jumps out of her chair, puts her head in my chest and tells me how much she loves the way I love her. And all I think is women. I have no idea what she's talking about. She's weeping in my chest. She says, Dad, I didn't know how to tell you. I mean, it wasn't Derek's fault. I let him on and I didn't know how to get out of it. And I didn't know how to tell you about it. And I don't want you to hate him. And I don't want you to hate me. And I, you know, blah, blah. And we talk for 2 hours. We never get to dance class. We go home. She gives me her diary. And so I can read the stack of diaries and the stuff she was messing with. And from that moment on, we're like this. I never told her to bring her boyfriends home. She has 3 boyfriends she brings home. She marries the third one. Right. She wants them to meet me. It wasn't, you know, all of a sudden, you know, we connected. And I realized that it was who I was for her that made the difference, not what I was doing. And sure. She told me, the way you failed for me, it communicated your love for me. That made a difference. And you wouldn't give up. So it's those kinds of life lessons. You know, I think we have a tendency that if something doesn't work, we just give up.
Right.
So if I keep working with who I am, if the possibilities are going to emerge. And usually they emerge as threats first, and then they open up as possibilities. I got to face into them.
Yeah. Dan, I could talk to you as we know, we've done this before all day long, nonstop, but we got to close it up. Yeah, what's something please. I didn't ask you that I should have asked you, you wanted to make sure you shared before we go?
Ah, well, okay. Do you have a podcast? Well, yes, we do. Thanks for asking, Robin. It's called the Naked Leadership Podcast. You should check it out. It's on Apple. In fact, you could put it in the link below.
Absolutely. And it will be on the show notes. And speaking of show notes, Dan, where can people go to find out more about you and what the great things you and Adrian and your wife are doing together to save the world? Because that's what she's doing.
That's what she's doing in my world. TakeNewGround.com. That's TakeNewGround.com. And there's all kinds of stuff you can look at there. And you can also reach out and connect with us. I'm on Instagram. I think that'll be there in the below. Well, and so is Adrian and Adrian Kaler. You can get a hold of him. He was on another previous episode, but we're available. We'd love to talk with you. And it's our privilege to jump in the middle of chaos and order. Like our job is to order chaos and release beauty. That's what we see our job to do.
I absolutely love it. And you did it during this episode as well, man. Who wouldn't want you in their lives? So it's perfect. Dan, thank you so much for coming on, sharing. The bravery to share your story and be so transparent and vulnerable is inspiring for the world. So just that alone, I thank you for, but I thank you for so much more. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. I really appreciate it. Always enjoy talking to you. You're such a bright light. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Forged by Trust. Remember, if you want to forge trust, it's not how you make people feel about you that matters. It's how you make them feel about themselves. If you're interested about more information about how I can help you forge your own trust building, communication, interpersonal strategies as a speaker, your coach, or as a trusted advisor for you or your organization, please visit my website at www.peopleformula.com. I'm looking forward to sharing my next Forged by Trust episode with you next month when we chat with the inspirational Carol Metz-Murray as we discover the leader within.